Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on cross-examination when we come back. Well, those who already walk submissively will say that there is no cause for alarm. But submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage, and the Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people, and the Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press of political and social activities free from government surveillance. Ah, you say the words of a radical, an anti-government, a lawless individual. No, I wished I'd have thought of that myself, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes, our politicians, beller in the halls of our Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control, but you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. And that's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from our political process. It certainly doesn't come from our politicians, our lawyers, or our bureaucrats. Now, old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me echo that point by saying, you give me the judicial power and I care not who makes the laws either, because the real power in America is in our courts, not in our politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into that power of the courts, why don't you call us here at the law school, the number is 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary. It's a commentary on the law school, but it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, the school, is available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Click on to the email and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time we took up the subject of cross-examination. I said that there are 23 techniques that we use in cross-examination. I showed you humor last time. The 23 are, we use humor, we use details to impeach the testimony of an adverse witness, we may rely upon collateral matters or memory, or an expose, or a demonstration. We may flatter the witness or use confrontation. Maybe memorization or contradictions and inconsistencies in testimony. Explanation and embarrassment. We use tests. We use hypotheticals. We tap into overconfidence. And we use many witnesses. We have what we call the trump card, the high point, silent cross, and eyewitnesses to impeach testimony of liars. We use the power of suggestion and friendly, impartial inquiry and partisanship to trip up our adverse witnesses. Now, remember last time I said that the best thing that can happen to you is that your opponents lie about you. You know, most people would say, well, that's the worst thing that could happen. They're lying about me. No, that's the best thing. The worst thing that can happen to you is that your opponent tells the truth about you. There's no defense against the truth. That'll lay you away every time. But if they're lying about you, I can uncover those lies, and so can you. and you can show the judge and the jury that that guy that's on the witness stand is lying by having him contradict himself out of his own mouth. There's a biblical quotation. King David used it against a guy one time. He said, "Out of your own mouth have you condemned yourself." Which leads us to this conclusion, and that is all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. Remember, when you rob a bank and you run out of the bank with a bag of cash, and three witnesses on the sidewalk later come into court and point at you sitting at the defense table and say, "That's the guy that we saw running out of the bank." When the bank teller points her finger at you and says, "That's the guy that put the gun in my face and robbed me." And when they play the surveillance tape and your picture is on the surveillance tape with a gun pointed at the teller over there, all of that evidence was created by you. Nobody else. Now, if you're not the guy that's on the videotape surveillance, you weren't at the bank, and you're innocent, and these people are pointing the finger and saying, "Hey, that's the guy over there that did it," then it's time for you to get on the witness stand, number one, and deny it, and create the contested issue of fact. You know, most of the criminal convictions that come down in the absence of any testimony from the defendant himself, which, after all, is good thinking on the part of defense attorneys, because 85% of their clients are, in fact, guilty. But of the 15% that are innocent, failure to deny the allegations that are being made against you are fatal. Well, they're fatal 94% of the time, because that's the number of times that you'll go into court out of 100 and lose your case. 94% of criminal defendants lose. So if you want to win a criminal case, then you've got to do something different than the average ordinary Joe Sixpack. Well, at least the ordinary Joe Sixpacks that lose 94% of the time. And after all, we're not here to exonerate or to help guilty defendants beat the rap. We're here to help those 15% that are innocent and are being caught up and convicted of crimes that they didn't commit. So let's learn how to do that. One of the techniques that we learn in cross-examination is called pay attention to details. Pay attention to the details. Now listen to this story. J.W. Donovan, the author of Modern Jury Trials, quotes the Brooklyn Eagles' account of a trial conducted by Charles Spencer against the late Edwin James as opposing counsel involving a soldier's claim for $1,800, money loaned to a friend after the Civil War. The defendant's counsel, Mr. James, cross-examining the plaintiff, asked, question, "You loaned him $1,800? Answer, "I did, sir." Question, "When, sir?" Answer, "In 1866. Question, "Where did you get it?" Answer, "I earned it, sir." Very meekly. Question, "When did you earn it?" Answer, "During the war, sir." Very meekly. And question, "What was your occupation during the war?" Answer, very modestly, "Fighting, sir." Now, up to this time, the issue had been much in doubt, but now the jury plainly leaned to the side of the soldier. Colonel Spencer, sensing this, closed the evidence as quickly as possible, and he summed up to the jury about the soldier who guarded our liberties, helped to save our nation, risked his life, and he won the verdict. Commenting upon the case later that day, Mr. James said to Colonel Spencer, "Well, that war speech of yours did it, and it was all the fault of my cross-examination. Otherwise, you would have known nothing about his war record." "Ah," said Colonel Spencer, "the mistake that you made was that you didn't find out that my client was a Confederate soldier, or you could have changed the whole verdict yourself." Now, that's the power of details. The cross-examiner opened the subject matter, but he didn't go far enough into the details. The devil is in the details. Had he asked, who were you fighting for? I was fighting for the Confederate Army. The case is being tried in New York City. Not very likely that a New York jury, a jury of Yankees, is going to give a Confederate soldier any compensation. Here again, one of the techniques that we use falls into one of those 23 categories that we use to find out the answer to our question. Now, in this case, we presume that the guy did in fact loan him the money, and in fact he had the money coming to him. Whether he was a Confederate or not is irrelevant and immaterial. He loaned him the money. Did he pay it back? The guy says, no, he didn't pay him back. This takes us to a subject matter called collateral matters. And after all, his military record was a collateral matter to the central subject of, do you or do you not owe this guy the money? Did you or did you not lend him the money? Did he or did he not pay you back? Here's an example of collateral matters. When we deal with the subject of collateral matters, we're talking about whether or not this guy has, or whether or not we're staying on point, or whether or not the subject matter at hand has been covered. Now, in the O.J. Simpson trial, the subject, Mark Furman, was testifying about O.J. Simpson and said that Simpson was a murderer, and his point was that he wanted to show that Simpson had killed his wife, and his point was that there was evidence, and he was on the stand as a detective to testify against O.J. Simpson. And F. Lee Bailey, who has been called the greatest cross-examiner, well, since, I guess, Francis Wellman back in 1902, put Furman on the stand and asked him a series of questions for about 3 hours. And I watched that cross-examination and I said, why, he never laid a glove on Furman. Here's the greatest cross-examiner in history, or at least in modern times, and he never laid a glove on that guy. I was disappointed, quite frankly. A week later, Bailey brought Furman back, put him on the stand, and asked him essentially the same questions. And this time, remember, it was over the N-word. And he tripped him up on this nigger and N-word, and do you use the N-word? Do you remember that famous N-word? Well, Furman had denied that he had ever used the N-word, and right away when somebody says to me they never used the N-word, I know the guy's lying right there. We all do. We all listen to jokes. We all hear it, and we all use it from time to time. So when somebody says he never uses the N-word, you can just about bet the guy's lying to you. Oh, he wants to be politically correct and well thought of, but he's not telling the truth. And as it came out, this guy Furman, when he was asked, have you ever used the N-word in the last 10 years? Well, 7 years prior to that, he made a videotape. Do you remember that? And in that videotape, he was using the nigger word over and over again. Well, wait a minute. Are we here talking about race relations in the O.J. Simpson case? No. We're talking about murder. That's the subject matter. But Furman was taken out on collateral matters. Now here's a classic example of this collateral matter and the way you use it. Henry E. Lazarus, he was a prominent merchant in the city. That was New York City. He was indicted a few years ago by the federal grand jury, charged with the offense of bribing a United States officer and violation of the Sabotage Act. Lazarus was honorably acquitted by a jury after a 30-minute deliberation. It was during the height of the war, and Mr. Lazarus was a very large manufacturer of rubber coats and had manufactured hundreds of thousands of these rubber coats for the government under contract. Now, the government, for its protection, employed large numbers of inspectors, and in the heat and excitement of war, These inspectors occasionally tried to make good, as the term was used, and one of these efforts resulted in the indictment of Lazarus. The chief witness against Lazarus was Charles L. Fuller. Fuller was the supervising inspector attached to the depot quartermaster's office in New York City. Fuller testified that Lazarus gave money to him to influence him in regard to his general duties as an inspector, and to overlook the fact that Lazarus was manufacturing defective coats and thereby violating the Sabotage Act. Well, Martin W. Littleton acted as chief counsel for the defense and was fully appreciative of Mr. Lazarus's high character and his conscientious discharge of his duties in the manufacture of material for the government. He was also well informed as to the general character and the history of the government's chief witness, Mr. Fuller. So after Fuller had completed his testimony in chief, he was first questioned closely as to the time when he became an employee of the government. Now, counsel, knowing that he was required to make and sign and then to swear to an application as to his prior experience. Now, a messenger had been sent to the government files to get the original of this application, signed by the witness, and he came into court with the document in his hand just as counsel was putting the following question to Fuller. The first question was, "Did you sign such an application?" Fuller answered, "I did, sir." And the next question was, "Well, did you swear to it?" Answer, "No, I did not swear to it." Question, "I show you your name signed on the bottom of this blank and ask you if you signed that application for employment with the United States government." Answer, "Yes, sir, I did." Question, "Do you see the word sworn to?" Answer, "I had forgotten it." "You see, there is a seal on it." "Well, I had forgotten that also." Question, "This application appears to be subscribed to on the 24th day of May 1918 by Charles Lawrence Fuller." Answer, "It must be right if I have sworn to it on that date." Question, "Well, do you remember in May of 1918 that you signed and that you swore to this application?" Answer, "That is so. I must have sworn to it. That is my name on the application. That is my signature. Do you remember that?" Answer, "Well, let me look at it and I can probably refresh my memory." Defense counsel handed the application for employment to the witness and asked this question. He says, "Look at that signature. Does that help you to remember that you signed it?" Answer, "Yes, that is my signature." Question, "You said that. Do you remember in May of 1918 that you signed and swore to this, that this is a sworn statement?" Answer, "Well, the date is there." Question, "Do you know that?" Answer, "Yes, sir, I must have sworn to it. I don't remember the date." Question, "Don't you remember that you signed your name, Charles Lawrence Fuller, right there on the application?" Answer, "I did, sir." Question, "And you swore to this paper and you signed it, did you not?" Answer, "That date is correct there, yes, sir." Question, "Don't you remember you swore to it and the date that you signed to it?" Answer, "I swore to it." Question, "Was your name Fuller?" Answer, "Yes, sir." Question, "Has your name always been Fuller?" Answer, "No, sir." Question, "What was your name?" The witness protested against any further inquiry along that line, but counsel was permitted to show that his name at one time was Finkler, and that he changed his name back and forth from Finkler to Fuller. Counsel then proceeded to bring the witness down to the actual oath that he had taken when he made this application for employment to the United States government. Question. Now, Mr. Fuller, in your application you made to the government, on which I showed you your signature and affidavit, you attached your picture, did you not? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. And you stated in your application that you were born in Atlanta, Georgia, did you not? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. You were asked, when you sought this position, these questions. When were you employed, the years and the months, and you wrote in February 1897 to August of 1917, the number of years 20, where employed, Brooklyn, name of employer, Vulcan Proofing Company, amount of salary, $37.50 a week, also superintendent in the rubber and compound room. Question. You wrote that, didn't you, Mr. Fuller? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. And you swore to that, didn't you, Mr. Fuller? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. Now, Mr. Fuller, were you employed from February 1897 to August of 1917, 20 years, with the Vulcan Proofing Company? Answer. No, sir. Question. That was not true, was it, Mr. Fuller? Answer. No, sir. Question. And had you been assistant superintendent of the rubber and compound room? Answer. No, sir. Question. That was a false statement, wasn't it? Yes, sir. Question. And through my experience as chief inspector of the rubber and slicker division, that was also a false statement, was it not, Mr. Fuller? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. You knew that was a false statement, didn't you, Mr. Fuller? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. And you knew that you were swearing to a falsehood when you swore to it, did you not, Mr. Fuller? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. And you swore to it intentionally, did you not? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. And you knew you were committing perjury when you swore to it. Answer. I did not look at it in that light. Question. Didn't you know that you were committing perjury by swearing and pretending that you had been 20 years in this business? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. And you're swearing now, here, today. You're testifying under oath, are you not, Mr. Fuller? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. In a matter in which a man's liberty is involved, is it not? Answer. Yes, sir. And you know that the jury is to be called upon to consider whether you are worthy of belief or not, do you not, Mr. Fuller? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. When you swore to this falsehood deliberately and you wrote it in your own handwriting, you knew it was false. You swore to it intentionally and you knew that you were committing perjury, didn't you? Answer. I didn't look at it in that light. Question. Well, now, when you know that you are possibly swearing away the liberty of a citizen of this community, do you look at it in the same light? Answer. Yes, sir, I do. Mr. Littleton, defense counsel, then uncovered the fact that the witness, instead of having been 20 years superintendent of a rubber room with the Vulcan Proofing Company, as he had sworn in his own handwriting, was a stag entertainer in questionable houses. He was a barker at a Coney Island show. He was an advance agent of a cheap road show and had been published in the paper as having drawn checks that were worthless. The witness, fully admitting all of the details of his 20 years of questionable transactions, and the result was his total collapse so far as his credibility was concerned, and the government's case collapsed with him. Now, the point of the cross-examination and the design of the cross-examiner was to get the witness at the outset of his cross-examination into a position from which he could not possibly extricate himself by confronting him with this document. The document, written in his own handwriting, in which he would be obliged to admit that he had sworn falsely, the witness having been thoroughly subjugated by this process, would then, as he actually did, confess to 20 years of gadding about in questionable employment under different names, and thus completely destroy himself as a reliable witness in the eyes of the jury. Now, remember, that is called collateral matters. What's the subject matter of the case? Sabotage. What's the subject matter of this cross-examination? The witness lying about his application for employment to the government. Fuller may have been telling the truth. But who would believe the guy after he had been exposed with having told all of these lies on the application for his employment? That's the subject matter of cross-examination. It is to destroy the credibility of a witness. That's the purpose for cross-examination. Nothing more, nothing less. The purpose for cross-examination is to destroy the credibility of that witness. That's your job. And in this case, it was done admirably. Now, whenever we have an adverse witness, we cannot use 23 of these various and sundry techniques. We have to select one or two or three, and then go after that witness on those one, two, or three. So one of the first things we do is we take a look at depositions, police reports, anything that's in writing, anything that this guy, this witness, has ever said in the past. Because we know that 25% of everything that came out of his mouth was a lie. I told you that in the last program. 25% of everything that comes out of a witness's mouth is untrue. And I showed you last time that when somebody asks the question, "Are you a liar?" Just test this. Next time you're in a little group of people, you just ask this question. How many of you here are liars? And they'll look at you like, "My God, you must be crazy. None of us are liars, and even if we were, we wouldn't admit it." Well, if they wouldn't admit it, well, then they're lying, aren't they? I remember one time I was in court, and they wanted me to swear an oath. And the judge said, "Raise your right hand, Mr. Gordon." And I said to the judge, his name was Judge Grant, I said, "Raise my right hand? Judge, what if I raised my left foot and cocked my head to the right? Would that suffice?" He thought that was kind of contemptuous behavior, and he told me so. He said, "No, Mr. Gordon, if you get lippy with me, I'm going to hold you in contempt." And I said, "Well, no, I don't think I want to raise my right hand and swear." And he said, "You have to. It's the law." I said, "I didn't know that." So I said, "Now, Mr. Gordon, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?" And I'm just standing. I haven't raised my hand yet. And I said, "No, sir, I do not." Now, think about that question for a minute. The judge says, "Do you," he's asking a question, he says, "Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?" You know, if you just take that statement apart, "Do you, Mr. Gordon, swear?" Did you know that the Bible prohibits swearing an oath? And back in those days, we were in Idaho, and they had you place your left hand on the Bible, in the courtroom, on the Bible, and raise your right hand and repeat after, typically it was the clerk, "Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God?" Kind of a simple little statement. Why don't we ask the question, what is truth? Did you know that the Bible tells you the answer to that? It says, "Thy word is truth." Thy word is truth. The word of God is truth. The scripture says, "Let God be true, though every man be found a liar." All men are liars. God is the only one around that tells the truth. And the scripture says, "Thy word is truth." And what was the first question they're going to ask you when you get through? You ever notice this? Everybody says, I do. You all know the answer. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help you God, everybody knows the answer. I do. You may be seated. And you sit down, and the first thing they ask you is, what is your name? And you tell them, well, my name is Sally Sixpack. And the first question and the first answer is a lie. Because in your oath, you swore to tell the truth. And what is the truth? Thy word is truth. The scripture is the truth. And you said, I'm going to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Is your name anywhere in the Bible? And is the whole Bible composed of your name? The very first words out of your mouth are a lie. And so the first thing that I did some years back when I took a look at this oath and we decided to challenge it, I said to myself, I don't think I'm going to do that in the future. So the judge asked me, says, well, are you a conscientious objector? And I said, I was. He said, well, then would you take this affirmation? I affirm to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. And I said, no, I don't think I want to do that either. And he said, well, you got to do one or the other. I said, no, I don't think I want to do either one. And the judge says, well, if you don't, then I'm going to hold you in contempt. And I said, are you going to hold me in contempt because I'm a pathological liar? I asked him that question. Are you going to hold me in contempt of court because I am a pathological liar? Now, boys and girls, if it is true that God is true and every man is a liar, then it looks like to me that our pathology is that we're all liars. Well, I must be a pathological liar. I mean, I didn't necessarily want it to be that way, but I didn't make it that way. I'm just reporting facts. And I've never met a man yet, and I'm an old man now, but I've never met a man yet that never lied. I haven't met a man yet that ever said to me, I have never lied in my life, and I will never lie as long as I live. I haven't met one like that. Ask your little audience next time you get a chance, and we'll find out how many liars you got in the group. Hang on, I got to give you a reminder here, and we'll be back with more on cross-examination right after this. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Remember, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and they can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, history, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, to order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, that's georgegordon.org, or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. All right, let's take a look at this thing called partisanship. I have to flip over here a few pages. A little story here about the New York Fireboat Company. It's on page 163 and 164 of the book, The Art of Cross-Examination by Francis Wellman. The Art of Cross-Examination by Wellman. Edgar James Swift, he's a professor of psychology at Washington University, and in his volume titled Psychology and the Day's Work, first published in 1918, some 10 years subsequent to the suggestions on this subject as far as it relates to the testimony of witnesses offered by me in a previous edition, has devoted many pages to a very interesting and instructive discussion on this subject. It is a book with which every earnest student of cross-examination should be familiar. Professor Swift relates some very interesting experiments in human observation that he has carried out with his psychology classes, from which he draws this conclusion, and that is, quote, "My experience and my experiments have proved to me that in general, when the average man reports events or conversations from memory, and then conscientiously believes that he is telling the truth, about 1/4 of his statements are incorrect. And this tendency to false memory is the greater the longer the time since the original experience." Now, Professor Swift states that upon one occasion, when the regular work of one of his classes was in progress, the following scene, which had been carefully rehearsed, was suddenly enacted before the eyes of all of the students who were seated in a semicircle in the classroom. An altercation was heard in the corridor, and when the door burst open and 4 students, 2 young men and 2 young women, dashed into the classroom. Miss R., immediately after entering the room, dropped a brown paper package on the floor. This package contained a brick, so that the occurrence might not be too inconspicuous. K. flourished a large yellow banana as though it were a pistol, and all struggled across the room to the side opposite the door where Professor Swift himself was seated among several members of his class. Professor Swift stood up at once, protesting at this interruption, and as the professor arose, he threw a small torpedo on the floor. H. fell back, crying, "I am shot! I have been shot!" He was caught by Miss R. All 4 then hurried out through the open door, Miss T. picking up the brown paper package which had been dropped near the door by Miss R. Now, this entire scene occupied less than 30 seconds. And it was startling to the class. All of the class members jumped up and crowded back against the wall, believing that it was, in fact, a real riot. Now, the class contained 29 students, and the 29 students of the class were then told by Professor Swift that this entire scene had been made to order. And they were then asked to sit down and to write out in detail their memory and their observations of what had just occurred. Now, 3 of the actors were actual members of the class, and Miss R., although she was not a member of the class, she was a senior, and she was prominent in college activities, and every one of the 29 members of the class knew her. Of the 29 eyewitnesses to this transaction, only 3 remembered that 4 persons had entered the room. And although no disguises were used, not a single person could recognize all 4 of the actors. Many of these descriptions described the occurrence of that of a mob or of a crowd. 7 students recognized 3. 11 students recognized 2. 7 students recognized one, and 4 recognized no one. Yet all of these actors were persons that they met every day, and as surprising as these figures may seem to those who think that even under excitement they could recognize an acquaintance whom they had seen at least 3 times a week for 8 months. The results, however, were nevertheless too favorable to observation and memory, for recognition by elimination of those present played an important role. 8 members of the class saw persons who not only took no part in the performance, but were not even present. Of these 8, 1 student saw a former member of the class who had withdrawn about 3 months earlier, and a young woman who had never been in the class and was not present was seen by 2 witnesses. The descriptions of clothing were so general as to be worthless for purposes of identification, and if details were given, they were generally found to be inaccurate. Only 1 witness spoke of the brown paper parcel. No one saw Miss T pick up the parcel. Several students saw the flash of a pistol, and 1 young woman wrote that they were attempting to hold back a man with long black hair. This evidently referred to H, since the other young man, R, had light hair and followed H into the room. H's hair, however, was short, and the description was that of a young Italian who had been a member of the class earlier in the year, but who had withdrawn from the class several months before this experiment. Later, this student, in her deposition, actually named that Italian as among the participants. 5 of the reports did not contain a single item of truth or fact. 3 witnesses saw nothing except a confusion and a mob bursting into the room. 6 others were unable to testify to more than the identity of 1 of the participants. To these, all else was a blank. Professor Swift draws this conclusion from his experiment. Identification is always fundamental in criminal cases, and positive recognition by well-intended, uninterested persons is commonly accepted unless the alibi is convincing. In our drama experiment, the observers were all well acquainted with the participants, and yet they were surprisingly incompetent as eyewitnesses. Their minds were prepared, had the event involved a real crime, to recognize one against whom there might appear to be corroborative evidence. The witnesses proved to have had little definite knowledge of what actually happened, and had a crime actually been committed, their testimony should have had very little value. Yet, it would have been accepted because they were, after all, eyewitnesses. Only a few identified actors, and in several instances these identifications were so uncertain as to be readily transferred to someone else under the influence of suggestion. In estimating the accuracy of memory, Professor Swift gives some very illuminating additional experiments that he made with his classes, showing through how many mouths a story must pass before it loses its identity altogether. Now, I want you to notice here that one of the statistics was that of the 29 people present, 8 identified people who did not take place, who did not participate in this event, which is entirely consistent with the statistical analysis that we see today in 2005, when we see that 30% of criminal convictions in rape cases are false, 8 being approximately 25% of 29. Now, keep that in mind. We know that 30% of rape convictions are false. And yet every one of those rape convictions has an eyewitness, a female who points her finger at the defendant, sitting at the defendant's counsel table, and she says, "That's the man that raped me." Now, every judge in America knows this story of Professor Swift's experiments. In fact, these experiments have been conducted for decades after 1918. And they're very sophisticated, done today with video cameras and technology, with questions that are already pre-written, and they can be given to. You don't have to sit down and write out from your memory. We'll ask you 100 questions. And you will answer 25 of those 100 questions inaccurately. And when we challenge you, when we say, for instance, the story that I saw, I'll describe a little of it for you. It was a group of, eight people, two female adults, two male adults, and four children. And they were water skiing and picnicking along a lake where there was a dock, and there was a little, building. It actually wasn't a building. It was a roof on four poles with a picnic table under it, similar to what you see at these rest stops. And these people would get in the boat, and they would take off from the dock, and they would water ski, and they would come back, and they were doing activities. And of course, some of the questions go like this: What color was the boat that was used in this depiction? Now, you've been watching this for an hour, but did you pay attention to what color the boat was? It was dark colored. Was it black? Was it dark blue? Was it dark gray? It was dark colored, but what color was it? Was it an inboard or an outboard motorboat? If it was an outboard motorboat, what kind of a motor did it have on it? Was it a Johnson, an Evinrude, a Mercury? What was the horsepower? Now, when you go back and you look at the film, the videotape, you can see that it's a Mercury 65. It's an outboard, not an inboard, and that the boat is dark blue. But if you don't think about, and if you're not taking cognitive notes as you're witnessing, as you're watching this event, when it's all over, yes, you saw this. It's like going to a movie. Yes, you saw the movie. Now, if I ask you specific questions, what was John Wayne wearing? What color was his hat? Was he wearing a plaid shirt? You know, was he wearing cowboy boots? What color was his horse? You know, if you're not paying attention, and what trips people up is that they guess at the answers. They say John Wayne was wearing Levi's. Most of the time in the movies he does, but not always. And was his shirt plaid? Well, in this case, it was plain color blue. You know, maybe he was wearing a black hat, but you're guessing that it's white, because typically John Wayne always wore a white hat, but not always, typically. So you may be making answers that you can't remember from the event that transpired, but remember, you're acting as an eyewitness. Now, notice that one of the students said, and this was kind of funny, he said that the gun, he saw the flash of a pistol. Several students, not one, but several students say they saw the flash of a pistol. But do you remember? It was somebody holding a banana. Now, would you want to come into court and testify that I saw this guy shot with a banana? Yet, as a witness, that's what you should be testifying to. Yes, I heard a shot. Yes, I saw the man holding a banana. And then the cross-examiner would say, are you telling this court that you saw this man shot with a banana? Yes, sir, that's what I saw. I saw him shot with a banana. Now, everybody smelled the torpedo. A torpedo, now, for some of you might not know what that is, it's a little device that's like a firecracker. and you throw it up in the air and it comes down and it's got a plunger in the nose of it. Goes off like a bomb. It looks like a bomb. You know, the kind of bomb that you drop out of an airplane and it heads down and it's got fins on the tail of it. And it drops straight down. And when it hits, aiming straight down, it goes off and it goes bang. All right, well, that's what that torpedo does. It goes bang, and it's got gunpowder. And so you're going to smell the gunpowder. You're going to smell a shot. And remember, the guy says, oh, I've been shot. You're an eyewitness. Now, a witness should testify to what he saw, what he heard, and what he knows, and nothing more. If you don't know that this guy has been shot, and you say, well, it appears that he was shot with a banana. What would make you say that? Well, I smelled gunpowder. You smell gunpowder and the guy was shooting with a banana? Yes, sir. That's what I saw. That's what I heard. That's what I smelled. And then let other witnesses come in and testify to what they know, what they heard, and what they saw. If everybody did that, 29 witnesses could have told the whole story. You know, the Hindenburg, the 1937, crashed in New Jersey, and about 60 witnesses came into the inquest, and they said the fire started on the top side near the tail. Two witnesses who weren't there in the terminal, but were in a hangar on the other side of the Hindenburg, said it started in the middle of the Hindenburg, went to the back, went up the back to the top of the tail. Those two witnesses were totally discounted. They were not believed. But the majority of witnesses who all testified that the fire started at the top of the tail, the vertical tail fin, were all believed. From 1937 until about 1985, that story was believed. It was the official text. But in about 1985, I believe it was, or maybe it was 1995, I forgot exactly now, but I read a story, a forensic evidence story. And this guy took some of the pieces that were still, that had not been burned up in the Hindenburg, and he subjected those to forensic tests and scientific evidence, and he came to the conclusion that the two witnesses were exactly correct, that the fire started from static electricity in the middle of the blimp on the other side, and then it traveled down to the rear of the blimp, up around the side to the top tail fin. So the fire was started by static electricity. Now, the scientific evidence is irrefutable, but the 60 or 70 eyewitnesses, as you can see from this, their testimony is refutable. And here's the sad part. Juries are never informed of these facts. And all lay people believe eyewitnesses when they testify. And defendants are kept off the witness stand by their attorneys. Their defense attorneys tell them not to testify. So here's this woman. She gets up, points her finger, and says, that's the guy that raped me. And the guy who's being accused never gets on the witness stand and testifies, no, I did not rape her. I wasn't the guy that did that. And then subject himself to cross-examination. If he can hold up to cross-examination, you know he's telling the truth. If he can't, then you know he's lying. Just like Fuller, I showed you a little earlier. Fuller was lying. Fuller was a liar. He was exposed as a liar. And he was lying about something that was totally collateral, wasn't central to the case at all. The case was over sabotage. But the cross-examiner skillfully discredited this government witness's testimony. Now, let me tell you something here from my personal experience. I have done some 60-plus cases. I think it's around 64, 5, or 6 cases now over the past 20 years. And I have been in court facing, examining, and cross-examining many, many policemen. I'm not going to tell you it's hundreds, but I can tell you that it was at least 30 policemen have been on the witness stand that I have cross-examined. Probably closer to 100, but I'll shorten it up. I won't exaggerate. I'll tell you it was 30. I'm telling you it's probably closer to 100, but let's just bring it down by two-thirds. In all of the years, 21 years as a cross-examiner in many different scenarios, with policemen on the witness stand testifying, I have only found one policeman that told the truth when he was on the witness stand. One. And his name was John DeLeonard. He was a deputy sheriff in Ada County, 1983. I put him on the witness stand and I started this examination. When I got all through, I couldn't crack him. The guy told the truth. He never varied. He didn't get in with the other six. Now the other six all lied. Best thing ever happened to me. I was the defendant. And when I put them on the stand, one at a time, and asked them a series of questions, all six of those witnesses contradicted the other five witnesses. Every witness contradicted some statement, some element of their story. Now, boys and girls, you cannot tell 10, 15, or 20 consecutive lies and then come back 6 months later and tell the same 10, 15, or 20 consecutive lies a second time without contradicting yourself. But if you're telling the truth, you can come back 6 months later and tell the truth 15 or 20 times. You can come back and tell the truth as long as you live. But you cannot tell a series of lies. And you saw that in the Fuller examination. And the thing that made the Fuller examination so good was that the defense attorney actually had the document that he had sworn to. He had the document, the application for employment, in which Fuller, in his own handwriting, we can do this with depositions, we can do this with police reports, we can do this with statements or reports that are made by people, and if they're lying, we can use any one, and sometimes two or three, of these techniques, 23 techniques, of which this thing of eyewitnesses contradict themselves. Eyewitnesses are unreliable witnesses. Or we can use humor, as I showed you in the last program. We can use details. The devil is in the details, or we can use collateral matters. Now, I've covered four with you. Humor, details, collateral matters, and eyewitnesses. These are actual cases. The transcripts are available. I'm going to show you next time some more of these 23 techniques that you can learn as a truck driver, a housewife, a mechanic, a carpenter, a plumber, electrician, I don't care who you are, or what walk of life you come from. You can learn to train yourself to identify a liar and to expose those liars in front of everyone. Someday, it may mean the difference between life and death or jail for you. Tuck it away in your heart. All right, we're just about out of time. I've got to leave it right here. Let me give you a final reminder, and we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. Remember, you're listening to The Law Hour, and The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, history, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. Thanks for listening, and until then, good night, friends.